I announced earlier that Justice Stratton is not able to be participating in oral arguments today, but she's read the briefs, and we tape the oral arguments, so she'll be participating in the decisions. Justice Resnick has recused herself from this case, and we're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Timothy Black, who Timothy McMonigle, a judge of the judge of the Court of Appeals for the 8th District. Mr. Hart. I want to make sure everybody's listening.
Yeah.
Well, I was.
Thank you, Your Honor.
It's like a field goal.
Thank you, Mr. Court. My name is Doug Harper, representing the St. Bell Telephone Company. This is an appeal from a cost proceeding before the Public Utilities Commission. It involves three separate and basically unrelated issues that arose out of that proceeding. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for a lot of
watch your time there.
First issue on appeal concerns the development of a cost study, which is a study that is designed to drive a price that Sitel will charge competitors if they decide to use a loop that is parts of Sitel network. There's no question of fact with respect to this issue on appeal. It's purely a question of law.
Okay, and as I understand it, on this particular question, you advocate using the actual. Is that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what is the percentage ratio that your company or your client submitted as actual versus the 80-20 relationship?
It's different by rate band, Your Honor, and there is a footnote in the brief that contains those precise numbers, but in the zone one, I think it's approximately 30% business, 35-65 residential. Zone 2 is like 2278, and I think Zone 3 is 1981, all the way weighted heavily in favor of the residential.
Okay, and what economic difference does that make?
In terms of the rate itself?
In terms of the rate itself.
I'm not sure we calculated that, Your Honor, because part of the result of this proceeding was to establish a number of parameters that would have to be used in compliance cost studies, which has just been filed with the commission, but we didn't do them using the actual wage because the order requires to use the 80-20. I believe it makes a difference of around a dollar or perhaps a little more on the price of the loop. So it may be as much as 10%, maybe a little bit more than that in the ultimate price.
Of a phone call?
No, of a phone call. What happens is, if I want to be a competitor in the Cincinnati area, I can go to Cincinnati Bell and say, you have a line that goes to this particular customer. Rather than build my own line to that customer, I want to use yours. And this is the rate that Cincinnati Bell would charge that competitor to use that line as part of its network.
On a monthly basis?
On a monthly basis, yes. Right. Yes. There's no question in this case that both FCC rules and the local competition guidelines that the Ohio Commission itself has written, that cost studies developing loop prices must be based on the entire universe of loops. And, you know, Cincinnati Bell, going into this case, was not real familiar with the teller process and how these studies work. And it made a mistake, quite honestly, and proposed an initial study that used this 80%, 20% weighting, which was an attempt to project what some competitors may want to use in the future. Turns out that's just the wrong way to go about doing one of these studies. And the rules are very clear about that. It says you must include all the costs that are attributable to an element, and you must use every element that's in that category. If it's loops, you must use every loop. If it's switches, you must use every switch, and so forth. So what we did well in advance of the hearing was supplement our testimony and request to change these studies so that it would use the actual loops and every one of the loops. The commission refused to do that. Really don't understand why, because there is no real rational reason given for that, other than, well, that's the way you originally started out. Well, before there was a hearing, before any testimony was formally introduced, we changed that, and we advocated using all loops in the commission.
To change that at that point would have made no difference in terms of man hours expended by the commission or anyone else.
That's correct, Your Honor. The change was made more than 6 months prior to the hearing.
Today, I assume it would make a difference. Has there been some expenditure of effort now?
Well, I'm not sure it would, Your Honor, because the way these studies work is company developed a price for a typical business loop, they developed a price for a typical residential loop, and the final step is merely combining those into an average. So rather than using a weighting of 80-20 to average those into a final rate, we just use the actual numbers, which have been known to the commission for about 3 years now. So these numbers are not anything new. Essentially, we're going to use a different formula to combine these two numbers than what the original studies had used. So as far as man hours, they can be done in a matter of a few minutes verifying that calculation. There's no further questions on that issue. I'll move to issue number two, which had to do with the charging rate of price in order to do what's called loop qualification.
Back to the issue one, just briefly.
Sure.
You said there seemed to be no rational reason. Aren't they? Didn't they also just decide they wanted to follow the federal regulation and that they could do that within their discretion?
Your Honor, I'm not sure they did that because the federal regulation also says you must use the entire element. And in fact, it not only says you must use all the costs that are attributable to the loops, but you must use every loop. And I believe that was in paragraph 690.
I thought that was an amendment.
I'm sorry?
I thought that was an amendment. You read so much in these cases, it's hard to remember. But it seems to me that they followed generally the guidelines of the Federal Communications Act.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In the first report we wrote to the FCC, paragraph 690, which is in our appendix at page 126, the FCC very clearly says that you're supposed to use all of the costs that are attributable to an element, which generally speaking of elements. And you also should use all the entire population of the elements. So I don't believe they actually cited any federal ruling to say otherwise. If I could move on to the loop qualification issue.
Before you get to that, can I ask you a threshold question? Yeah. Why do you think the Ohio Supreme Court has jurisdiction in this case and not a federal court, which was raised earlier by a then intervener and now amicus?
Several reasons, Your Honor, and those were briefed in our response to that motion to dismiss. The basic reason is that both courts have concurrent jurisdiction. Under Ohio law, this court has exclusive jurisdiction to hear appeals from cases decided by the Utilities Commission. So something would have to upset that before any other court would have jurisdiction.
Doesn't the federal code section upset that?
Does it indicate
exclusive jurisdiction and the circuit courts agree?
It does not, Your Honor. Okay. What the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction over are decisions approving or rejecting interconnection agreements. They also have parallel jurisdiction with state courts over other determinations that state commissions might make under the Act. And clearly, I don't have these sites on top of my head because I wasn't anticipating arguing that again, but clearly there are courts that say the federal courts don't even have the right to decide state law issues. And in this case, each of our three issues of appeal all involve questions of state law as well as federal law. So if we were to be in federal court, there would be the opportunity to argue the state law issues over which this court has exclusive jurisdiction.
Don't you see that possibly gives the potential problem of a federal interpretation and a state interpretation in the same state?
I think that's why we have the United States Supreme Court. If that were to occur, the Supreme Court has the ability to straighten those differences out. At this point, we don't have those differences.
Correct.
And on the three issues that we raised here, I'm not aware of any federal court decision anywhere that has decided any of these three questions. So this is a case of first impression, to my knowledge. If I may address the loop qualification issue, the Commission has raised a threshold procedural issue about whether this issue was properly before the court because it came up on rehearing. And I believe the cases cited by the Commission really are not apropos to the posture of this case. What those decisions have said is that if the party did not object to the original order on a rehearing, it can't bring those issues up for the first time on appeal. But what the Commission ignores is the fact that an order granting rehearing is a final appealable order. And if that's the case, who could possibly appeal the grant of a rehearing if you can't raise questions that were reversed on rehearing? And in fact, this court, although it wasn't issued before the court, at least two prior report cases has decided on the merits, issues that were first brought up through a reversal on the hearing. And that's both the Columbus and Southern Ohio Electric case and the Cincinnati Development Depreciation case, both decided in 1984. In one case, the original order allowed construction work in progress to be counted as part of the rate base. On rehearing, that was taken back. In the Cincinnati Development case, the commission originally established one basis for depreciation for life, later changed that to remaining life. On both situations, the complaining utility appealed from the grant of a rehearing brought by some other party, and in both cases, this court heard that issue on the merits. This is exactly that situation. In the original order, our right to charge for loophole location was allowed. On rehearing, the commission reversed itself. We're entitled to appeal from that. On the merits of that issue.
Yeah, what is it? What's the dispute about?
The dispute here, Your Honor, is the hot thing in telecommunications right now is something called XDSL. And that's a service where you can use one telephone line for both a voice telephone, and you can put a computer on there and serve the internet using the same telephone line simultaneously. But it doesn't work on all telephone lines due to some technical limitations, depending on the length, depending on whether it was copper or fiber, depending on what devices might be in place on the line. So what the Federal Communications Commission has required is that incumbent LECs, like Cincinnati Bell, are required to, on inquiry by a CLEC, a competitive local exchange company, they're required to disclose to them what are the characteristics of a given loop. And in fact, if the loop in its current makeup would not support these advanced services, the commission has required the incumbent companies to do what's called conditioning, to make that loop into a different form so that it will support that service. In both cases, we're entitled to be compensated for the costs that are incurred by that. The FCC specifically, in one of these remand orders, and Justice Douglas, this may be what you're thinking of, ordered that you have to condition these loops, and it also said you're entitled to be compensated for that. Mm-hmm. Further, there was an issue about should the competitive company be given access to an automated database that might show this information. The CLECs were requesting that the FCC actually order companies to create these databases that may not have existed, and the Federal Communications Commission refused to order that. It said if they exist, you're entitled to them. If they don't exist, you have to use the same paper process everybody else uses.
Yeah. What are you arguing about here?
What we're arguing is the commission originally said, well, if you have to use the paper process, we know you've got to send a man out to look at the paper and decide what are the characteristics of this loop. Originally, they said you're entitled to be paid for that man's time to do that work. On rehearing, they said, well, no, since you don't have this automated database, it would be a great, more efficient way of doing this. We're not going to charge for that man's time to do that. That's just confiscatory. We're requiring us to do a service. It has a cost. There was no dispute there was a cost. The commission didn't even get to the amount of the cost. It simply approved originally.
And we don't know at this point.
But it's in the record below. It's really irrelevant to the appeal. But it was roughly 55 minutes of the man's time, as I recall. It's a research on paper records as opposed to having a computer database. The commission gave it and then took it back. There really is no rational reason for taking it back.
55 minutes?
55 minutes of time per engineer to, if it's done on a single loop of time basis, yes.
Per loop?
Yes, yes. And really, as a practical matter.
We're talking about thousands of loops here.
It's really up to the CLEC as to what they request. And as a practical matter, what that means is now it's free. A CLEC can just randomly pick telephone numbers and tell Cincinnati Bell, I'd like to know what that loop looks like, and tomorrow I'd like to know what that loop looks like, and they can do this willy-nilly with no recourse.
Is this the commission trying to push a utility into being modern technologically and therefore supposedly saving customers money?
Well, you know, I can't really get into their minds as to why they're doing it. The original order of the commission said it's not cost-effective to develop the system because not every loop is going to be requested for the service, and it's just a waste of time to go and qualify everyone and have them in this database. We're not going to make you do that. On rehearing, the only reason they gave for reversal was that that's not part of the actual conditioning work, that this is just look at the loop and tell me what's on it, don't actually do the work. Since it's not part of actually doing the work, they, for some reason, decided we can't be paid for that. Well, it still works. It may not be conditioning work, but it is still work, and still bears the cost.
And I think when we talk about getting into their minds, and you say you can't do that, is the other part that I had problem with in the case. You were right, that's what I was thinking about, the remand issue. But You agree this is a TELRIC proceeding, don't you?
Yes.
And if it is, what specifically can you point to as an error of law that the commission violated when they ruled on the 80-20 issue? And the reason I'm asking that is because it appears to me that your argument is good, but so is theirs. And that if it is, then that's a manifest weight argument, and we affirm them on manifest weight. So if you can point to some specific requirement that adopting your original, your 80-20 proposal was an error of law, I'd like to know which section.
Of course, an error of law for two reasons. One, under the FCC order, paragraph 690, and the accompanying rule, which I can perhaps find this. I don't have it right here. I can look it up for you. I think it's 51.505, which talks about using the entire element. And also the Commission's local service guidelines, both it's Roman numeral 5B4B1 and Roman numeral 5B4B11. One says you're supposed to include all the costs of an element, and the other one says when you calculate the demand and the price of the rate, you have to use the total of all elements that the competitor is going to use and the total of all elements you're going to use yourself. So what that's saying is you calculate how much is it going to cost to build all the loops that you have, and how many loops do you have, and divide those two things.
Now, is that mandatory, or is it a judgment for the commission? They could also use the method they used.
As far as I know, it's mandatory. It's a guideline that the commission established for a rulemaking proceeding, and the FCC rule is certainly mandatory on the commission. There's no ability on their part to overrule it. The FCC says it was the right process for establishing the costs.
What were the two guidelines? One was 11. What was the other one?
Roman 5B4B1. And these are all in our appendix.
Council, you're right, Tom, but you haven't touched on the third issue.
Yes.
Quickly, Council, Mike.
It's hard to do quickly. And this is one where I'll confess there are some weight of evidence issues, but I'm trying to filter those away and deal with what are the legal issues. And the two that are weight of evidence issues are, should we have projected an increasing cost, or should we have used our baseline costs? That's a debate. And the other one is, what was the demand for use of this database? Were it 3 carriers, 4 carriers, 5 carriers? From our point of view, even if you took the worst case and said, exclude these additional costs that the commission may not think we're going to experience, use the maximum demand that the evidence would have supported, the rate would only come from approximately 18 cents per listing to approximately 10 cents per listing. What they did was impose a proxy rate of 6 cents, 4 cents per original, 6 cents per update, that was developed based on subscriber listings sold to publishers, which is statutorily a different animal than the DA database. The DA database is subject to Section 251. Subscriber listings are subject to Section 222 of the Federal Communications Act. They're two different things, supposed to be priced differently.
So they reached into the wrong, they used the FCC's.
They did, and Your Honor,
you argue they grabbed the wrong data.
They grabbed the wrong data because it doesn't apply to this database. And just there's one overarching question here. There was a joint department that handled both of these databases. There was an issue of how you allocate the cost between the two databases. This IFL chose to divide them evenly. There was a witness for an intervener who said that's too generous, you should only give a smaller percentage to the DA or to the subscriber listing database. When the commission adopted the subscriber listing database proxy rate, it made an assumption that these costs ought to be about the same between one database and the other. If that's the case, you have no choice but to accept the 50-50 allocation of this joint cost. It's either the same or it isn't the same. They apparently took a criticism that they aren't the same, but then when looking for something else to use as a proxy, they said, well, here's something that looks like it ought to be the same. Well, the same thing, they already said wasn't the same. So if it is or it isn't. Can't be
one of those. Thank you, Mr. Hart. Mr. Norris.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I have a different version of each of these three issues, not surprisingly. And I would suggest in all three that CBP is clearly asking this court to second guess the commission and reweigh all the evidence.
I thought that too, but on page 16 of their brief, they say there is no question that under the Telrick methodology, the entire universe of loops must be considered?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the 80-20 weighting issue, first of all, that they have a different interpretation of the Commission's guideline in Telrick than the Commission does. What that guideline does and what Telrick requires is that the total quantity be used. That was done in this case, okay? The company's own expert, their own cost studies, did this loop study on a per-loop basis. In other words, they did not do what Mr. Hart just described the guideline requires, which is his interpretation, of adding up all the loop costs across their whole network and then dividing that by the quantity. That is not how their study was done. That's not how any loop study has been done by any company before the Commission. What was done was it was developed on a per loop basis. So if you look at a cable or a particular facility, and they developed the cost based on a per customer or per loop basis. And so the study for each rate band, there was a residence study done and a business study done separately. Again, because the company chose to do that. The FCC's Telrick methodology prohibits a UNE rate from being de-averaged or classified based on type of service. In other words, a residence customer versus a business. So based on the way the company developed its cost study, the Commission had to mix those together to create a single rate and did so based on the company's initial position, which they maintained for several months up to prior to the hearing when they switched it. The Commission determined that the company's first position was better than its second position, which, by the way, would have a significant increase of the rate.
But they seem to say that the second position, as you define it, is mandatory.
Well, they would like to portray that, but I believe that's clearly incorrect. Their own study did not follow their interpretation of the guideline. I would also suggest that the FCC's regulation, Rule 505, does not, it's very ambiguous on this point, does not even require what the Commission's language says in its guideline. And, of course, the Commission's guideline was set forth at the beginning of this process. It's a bit of an academic question, really, what that guideline means. It was never intended as binding the Commission in all circumstances. But the Commission simply disagrees with their interpretation, and their own cost study is what caused the need to mix these rates back together.
So you say this is a manifest weight issue?
Absolutely.
And it's not any error of law?
Clearly not, Your Honor. The company
cites paragraph 690. Why is that not an error of law?
Again, the total quantity was used. There's no dispute about that. Every loop in the company's system was used, or a sample thereof, by the company with their cost expert to develop these costs on a per-loop basis. They did not add up all the loop costs and then divide them by the quantity. That's not how they did it. They started from a different premise and created the need to do this.
Counsel, in the Commission's decision to go with the 80-20, there are no issues of obsolescence or overbuilding. We saw in some other Telco case a year or two ago, or tax case perhaps, issues where lines are out there, but they're there for the future. And those kinds of issues of maybe having overbuilt a system in some fashion are not mixed into this decision.
No, the 80-20 represents the company's own projection and on their merit brief before the Commission, quote, reasonable projection of the types of loops CBT expected to sell as UNEs, at page 9 of the brief. They've maintained all along that this was a reasonable projection. They, however, wanted to use this other weighting that they know would raise the rate. The Commission, in its entry on rehearing, clarified also that moving away from the 80-20 mix would move away from the cost characteristics of the downtown, the so-called West 7th Street CO, or central office, and which is where all the competition is really occurring. So it was clearly a pro-competitive decision based on the record by the commission. The second issue that they raised, the loop qualification charge, first of all, I don't want to skip over the rehearing issue. That's very important. Our position is clearly based on the precedence of this court. CBT would have the court, and this is, I believe, a first impression. The court has not specifically addressed this circumstance in other cases. But the CBT would have the court adopt a position that said any time a rehearing position is a rehearing decision is issued, that any party could raise an issue to this court. That's clearly not what the statute provides. The last sentence of 490.310 provides without qualification as a condition precedent for all appeals that a party must file for rehearing.
And they
did not do so.
On this issue?
On this issue.
But this issue was redetermined.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And they lost the issue. They were satisfied with the original outcome, not satisfied
right.
with the subsequent outcome. It doesn't hardly seem fair that you would be prevented from presenting those issues. Under your interpretation,
you have to ask
for a rehearing on all issues, including those that you were satisfied with.
I don't believe it's
But how do you protect yourself from a loss on rehearing on an issue that was settled in your favor?
It's very simple. All they have to do is apply for rehearing, allow the commission to consider their arguments that they're presenting on that issue based on the commission's actual decision. And they need to raise their specific concerns. And that's the core procedural efficiency of the rehearing requirement that this court has always said is jurisdictional. So allowing them to skip over that, I believe, is unfair to the commission, and certainly it's not burdensome.
So that would be a rehearing on a rehearing?
Yes, Your Honor, that happens all the time.
Except it was before the commission, wasn't it? In the intervener's application for rehearing?
It was before the
intervener's application on rehearing was on the loop qualifications issue, and didn't you abrogate your original order?
They changed the result on rehearing, and that's the purpose of rehearing, for the commission to consider parties' arguments. And CBT did not bother to file a rehearing from that decision and raise its own issues with the result of its reach. And again, to complete the jurisdictional, statutory, unqualified prerequisite.
What if we rule against you on the rehearing issue and say it's appealable? Why shouldn't they be able to charge for their...
Your Honor, the commission did approve the conditioning charge for CBT. They glossed over that, but when they actually go out and do this work on loops and have to remove these devices and load coils, they do recover a charge. The commission approved that. What they're asking for is to get just to get an estimate on whether the work even needs to be done on a particular loop. They want to get paid for an estimate. The commission rejected their charge that they proposed based on the record. The decision that the commission issued in that regard is entirely consistent with the Telluride methodology.
Could I go back just one second to the rehearing issue?
Sure.
Where it wasn't CBT that moved for rehearing, but did they participate when there was the first level
they
of rehearing?
And opposed the other parties, yes.
On the other issues, or perhaps advocated the decision?
They advocated the original decision should be upheld, but they did not.
And they lost. They didn't prevail. Right. So they don't prevail. Then the concept that now, so everybody's involved in the trial, but now we have every time somebody, there's a decision, then anybody who's dissatisfied files again, so we would never have an end to that, would we?
No, certainly not, Your Honor. You only have to file for each issue one time.
But the issue was before the commission,
yes,
and they defended.
It was, but again, they didn't follow the statutory process. The language they rely on in 49.311 is purely timing language. It doesn't give any party license to file an appeal just because there was a rehearing order. It's purely timing. The last sentence in 49.310 is very, very clear, Your Honor, and that didn't occur here. But the commission's decision was consistent with Telluride. In fact,
Mr. Meddy, cost expert in CBT, admitted both in his testimony, written testimony, and cross-examination at transcript 5, 7980, and his additional supplemental 25-26, that these devices on a forward-looking forward-looking network, as Howard is required to assume for purposes of setting these rates, these devices would not be on the network, and these are not forward-looking costs. The company relies purely on the FCC order relating to conditioning charges, which again, the commission approved the conditioning charge here. The company tries to expand that exception to Telerate that the FCC created for conditioning into qualification, and that was not covered by the FCC's narrow exception and goes well beyond it. The commission also is concerned that really this proposed charge served as a barrier to competition. There, in the transcript 5, 46-49, Mr. Meddy admitted that the company, when it provides these advanced services to its own customers, has a pre-screening process where when customers call in and ask whether they can be provided this advanced service over a particular loop to their home, they have information that tells them in some cases, yes or no. They can do that instantaneously. When he was asked about whether competitors would have access to the same information, he wasn't sure. He couldn't provide any details on how that would be done. That's an equal footing issue for providing. And the commission is vitally concerned with promoting advanced services in Ohio.
Don't you agree that these are costs they're actually incurring because of the request to condition?
I think that's speculative, Your Honor, and I also... There's two parts to my answer there. First of all, their argument really doesn't hang together that these costs would be incurred, if at all, very often. It's undisputed that it's only the shorter copper loops that these advanced services, in particular ADSL, can be provided over. But those shorter loops are not the ones that need conditioning. And the downtown loops are the shorter loops. Transcript 4 and page 32. Mr. Meddy agreed. So it's very unlikely in areas where competition are currently occurring that these costs will even come into play. But even if they do in some instances, there's never a guarantee, either under traditional rate making or under this wholesale telework methodology rate making, that a particular customer will always cover 100% of their costs. And the rates are not required to be based on the company's version of cost, that they give an opportunity overall. And the company has not made any allegation that their overall earnings are in trouble or anything like that.
Counsel, can you give us the third issue here?
Absolutely. The DA database issue, the company attacks the process, not the substance of what the commission did. In fact, the company, as Mr. Harper pointed out, presented a test in a cost study the commission took issue with in major respects. The commission also had concerns about the intervener's cost study that was very low. And so what they did simply is mirror an FCC rate that just like they've done with access charges for a couple of decades now, they looked at the underlying service. The FCC in its subscriber listing order specifically concluded that the same information, the same database is used for direct assistance and also for publishing. That's really not a disputed matter. It's the same database and the same computer. So in the FCC, really CBT is collaterally attacking what the FCC did before this court, which is improper under the Hobbs Act. The FCC considered the same parties. CBT argued that it wanted to charge a rate that was thousands of percentage points higher than other companies, and MCI argued that it should be less than a penny. The FCC rejected that, chose the 4 and 6 cents rate as being more than incremental cost and allowing for a contribution to common or overhead costs.
And describe this service.
It's simply a database. So a competitor comes in and gets, whether it's tapes or discs or whatever, gets data at a certain date, point in time. They can get updates later, those too.
It's a service for
exactly the same
directory of all subscribers.
It's all subscribers within CBT's territory. The FCC determined that database, quote, reflects the carrier's unique monopoly-driven drive control over subscriber list information that the SLI was.
Mr. Hart argued that this was somehow a different.
The FCC was setting the rate for a different purpose under a different statute, but it acknowledged when it did that it was the same service. In paragraph 112 of that order, that is exactly the same database that's used for DA. The commission simply mirrored that here because the two cost studies that are presented were extreme. And so that's certainly the commission's prerogative.
Do you have to, is there a cost? In other words, if one director service wants this, but if three or four now competing companies want this, is the cost to produce it a second and third and fourth time?
Well, as the FCC concluded that the differences based on demand are incredibly small, and certainly the incremental cost is around a penny, so they're allowed to charge 4 to 6 cents depending on. There's plenty of opportunity to recover more than the incremental cost and a contribution to overhead, and that's certainly fair. We would ask the court not to second guess and reweigh the evidence in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. Mr. Hart, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
The federal regulation is 51.505, which talks about both the cost of the goods of the element and the total population of the element. I also want to clarify something on the subscriber listing issue. I guess I'm in an awkward position. I filed a motion yesterday with the court requesting leave to file an additional authority that has been released in the last week, but I couldn't have provided 7 days before argument and directed on this issue. May I address that?
No, you should just we'll rule on it, and then the other side have Mr. Norris have a copy of it.
Yes, you can.
Okay. No, I don't want you to argue today, but we'll certainly read it when you file it.
I want to point out that talks about the distinction between subscriber listings and DA databases.
He made a statement that the incremental cost to providing this is about a penny. That accurate?
Well, that's what I would like to take issue with. The FCC didn't have any cost study valid to make any judgment on. And what the FCC did in that subscriber listing order was it conducted a rulemaking proceeding, taking all this information that it gathered, it decided that it will allow carriers to charge at the minimum 4 cents and 6 cents. And that was before, but it was also deemed a proxy. And that order also said any company is entitled to come in and prove that their costs are higher. When MCI introduced this order after the hearing and after the briefing, but before the decision in this case, we filed a letter objecting to that, saying it wasn't appropriate and we didn't have an opportunity to prove our costs. Our point is our subscriber listing costs themselves are higher than the FCC's proxy. And if we say subscriber listings and DA databases ought to cost about the same, by logic, that means our DA prices are also, or costs are higher than this proxy rate. So the commission basically threw up its hands and said we're not going to decide this one and rely on a proxy, which itself should have allowed us to prove our rate was higher.
Your time's up, but remind us again you these acronyms like it was. DA is?
DA is Director Assistance, which is when you call up and say I'd like Johnson's telephone number. Subscriber listings are if I want to publish a telephone book, I can go to a telephone company and say I want to buy all the listings that go into your book so I can publish them.
But with the DA, they did follow the FCC. Which regulation is presumptively appropriate. Isn't that correct?
I believe it is, Your Honor. In fact, as our brief points out, the FCC has decided that DA databases are not unbundled elements. They're not subject to the public process. The commission's own guidelines to bring it back into the public process is Roman Rule 15.
The FCC does have presumptively reasonable rates, don't they?
Not for directory systems, they do not. They expressly have declined to do so. That's the case I'm trying to bring to the court's attention.
Okay. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open.